Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and also Google Plus and Periscope, at TotalTutor. And I'm honored to have on the show celebrity songwriter, author, jack of all trades. We all remember him from Growing Pains as Jason Siever, Alan Sick. Alan, thanks for calling in. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine, thank you.
So how's the weather where you're calling from right now? It's gorgeous everywhere, it seems like. We finally are not getting any rain anymore in Pittsburgh. That's good
news
for sure.
The usual California weather, and we never have any mudslides or drive-by shootings.
And for your unbelievable career, you got to be amazed at where you've gone from the beginning to now, and all the different things you've accomplished in your career.
It's been a wonderful ride. I've enjoyed the variety of my life. There's always a seems to be a variety going on at any given moment. We're ready for the launch of our season 3 of Unusually Thick, our sitcom reality show in September. Doing my annual Christmas movie for Hallmark, filming that next month, and I'm pretty excited to be representing an organization called ProCon.org. I hope your listeners will look that up. It's a charity, nonprofit research informational website for students or teachers or anybody who just wants to be really smart. And we're introducing a lot of new elements as we approach this election year, because it's a wonderful source for pro and con information about your candidates and the issues.
Well, that's a great education piece for sure, because when you think about it, everyone gets one side of the story, not both sides.
Not with ProCon. Proud to say that. Get everything you ever wanted to know about any issue.
And they take both sides of the story. I try to do that in my education shows with teachers and taking both sides for sure. Absolutely. And you were talking about your reality show. And so did you ever think you would do a reality show, especially in your career and all the different things you've done to do a reality show?
Well, I wouldn't do a pure reality show. Probably my life isn't that dramatic and fascinating. And also, I think reality shows, as we've come to know them, are being done very effectively by a lot of other people. So we would just be repeating what's out there. So we didn't do a reality show. We just had a sitcom reality where we're dealing with our real family. We're finding the funny way, and we're looking for the humor in everybody's family drama, and
we're having a lot of fun. Yeah, definitely. And it sounds like when you're talking about the reality show and the way, just trying to show the realness of your family, what it's about, how down to earth you are as a person, and it kind of even goes back to the days from Growing Pains, when people remember you as Jason Siever, in a way, saying, okay, I have a family, I'm not this person that is, I'm transparent and things like that. And that's what people get to see on the show, don't they?
Yeah, we've had some fun with the notion that this is what Jason Siever is really like at home. So, we tweak the format a little bit, and we occasionally feed our stories with the odd little extra bit of humor or drama, but it's pretty real. We're just playing it for laughs.
For sure. And when you talk about, what do you think was your greatest highlight of your career in acting? What would you say?
Well, I've the variety of my career has been really what the fun of it has been. I mean, creatively speaking, there were shows that I wrote and produced for Norman Lear and for, Richard Pryor and Flip Wilson, people like that on television. So those were my kind of creative highlights, I guess. But I've also had a lot of fun dabbling in music, and I like the acting part of my life. Jason Siever was very good to me. So it would be hard to pinpoint anything. I've enjoyed what I've done, and I'm happy to have those opportunities.
Well, one thing I did not know, that you composed some of the most hum-worthy TV theme songs with Different Strokes and Facts of Life. A lot of people don't know that about you, for sure. That was interesting when I read up on that. I never
knew. Yeah, that was a wonderful part of my past and my present, for that matter. I wrote the theme for our Unusually Thick show, and I continue to dabble in it, but... my son has become such a wonderful artist that I don't call myself a songwriter around him.
Exactly, but I mentioned. So, what did you do when you were mentoring him as a child? Did you let him just be creative, or did you kind of show? Did he get to see you at work, and did that help him grow as a talented musician?
Well, I certainly didn't teach him much anything about music, but I could expose him to a lot. And so I did that. He heard a lot of music and got to go to a lot of concerts with Dad. And hopefully that has some influence on him.
Well, definitely, for sure. And I guess seeing you in action at work is always a help as a father when you're trying to model that for your kids to understand what you do every day and what does Dad do. And when you're constantly on the go and going different places and doing different things, he sees it and says, okay. And it helped to have that opportunity. It's fantastic to see that the father-son team in so many ways with such success, for sure. Alan, when we're talking about ProCon.org and being part of that organization, I think that you are seeing, especially when we're talking about this presidential election, that we really have to get both sides, because people, again, are going to go and make the wrong decisions if they just take one side. By researching both, by going right now, the listeners right now, to ProCon.org, I think it's going to help tremendously for them to look at specific issues like Donald Trump, or issues like Hillary Clinton, or other things, and see what both sides say so that they can come to a good decision, not one that's spin, for sure.
That's true. That's exactly what ProCon is all about. In fact, we find that over 30% of the people who check out the website and access the information, over 30% end up changing their minds from the opinion they held before they checked in with us. So, and there were over 20 million users of the ProCon.org website last year. So it's actually a well-kept secret, mostly among academics and students, and as I said, anybody who just wants to be the smartest one in the room. But this year, because it's an election year, we're going to glam it up a bit and have some fun and make it very interactive and get people on board, get a lot of opinions from the public sector. And we expect to have it be very entertaining this next year as well as informative.
What it sounds like when you're talking about ProCon, and I think it's so great, is that you'll look at each individual issue as well, and you'll get the public's opinion. For example, education is something that I'm huge about in my conversations all the time on Twitter and everything. And to see what the politician's true stance is on education so that you can make that informed decision on each issue, I think it's great, and I think this is going to be one of the most entertaining presidential elections in a long time to come. As long as Donald Trump stays in, it's going to be a definite interesting thing. And then you have Hillary, and you have the other Bush, and it's just really going to be, I think, a huge buzz, and perfect for ProCon.org to provide that type of platform for people to check things out and not be swayed, but to really figure it out for themselves.
For sure.
Any other projects going on right now? You said, that, again, you have the reality show, you have ProCon.org. Anything else that you want to tell our listeners about?
No, those are, like I said, the variety of my life is the fun of it. Very excited about the prospect of ProCon.org, and looking forward to the launch of Unusually Thick in September. The Christmas movie, we'll be out promoting that appropriately around Christmas. And looking forward to Robin's album, which will be out in just a couple of months. He has a couple of songs on the charts right now, so lots of fun things going on.
And are you involved in his music at all, like in providing advice for him, meaning like in the Ferocean end of things? Because it seems like you're a great promoter in that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, not really. You know, he's so good at it, but I'm always flattered that he wants to hear my opinion as to a particular song or what the sequence on the album should be. And on a couple of albums, he's brought me in to write a lyric with him, and I've enjoyed that. So mostly I'm just a fan, and I'm trying to support and genuinely love what he's up to.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Best place we can find information on you, Alan, and learn more about you. And also, we know everyone should go to procon.org, but where else can we find info on you?
I guess I have a website that's pretty much up to date, so happy to get visitors and have people follow on Twitter, and we'll engage as much as possible.
What do you think of this whole thing now with the Internet and how you can get your message out so quickly? I think it's awesome.
It's quite brilliant and makes the world very immediate. And I'm still learning some of it. I don't exactly have the Kardashian regularity in terms of contributing to the Internet or using social media as Mike, but maybe we'll have some time to do that in the fall.
Oh, absolutely. And the last thing I wanted to say is if you've not tried Periscope yet, it was created by Twitter. It's another great thing to get to see the life of Alan Thicke in certain ways for a short snapshot. It's amazing what Periscope's doing to really give that immediate social media. A lot of celebrities are jumping on that. So if you've not tried it yet, Alan, I recommend you try it.
Okay, I appreciate the tip.
You're welcome. And best of luck. And anytime you'd like to come back on the show, please reach out to me. Give me some updates of what's going on with procon.org and all the other ventures with your son and everything. So thanks again for calling.
Thank you. You'll hear from us in the election year.
Oh, I will be there. And I'm going to definitely set up something for that. Okay? Sound good, Alan?
Yeah. Great. Thanks a lot. Yeah, appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, Alan. Thanks for taking the time. Okay. All right, see you later. All right, bye-bye. All right, that was Alan Thicke. That was the Total Celebrity Show. We'll be back very soon with another great episode. Take care, everyone. Thanks, Alan. Take care. Everyone, I'm so excited to be back on the air live again after a two-week hiatus, longest time I've ever taken off of radio. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, Google Plus, Neil Haley, and Periscope at TotalTutor. You know, it's just amazing. We start off with a really interesting guest, and anytime I get to interview someone from Congress, it's awesome, but the topic is unbelievable. So I'm excited to welcome the program New York Times best-selling author, Representative Chris Stewart. Representative Stewart, thanks for calling, and how are you?
Oh, I'm great. It's so good to be with you, and welcome back.
Welcome back. I was at Bethany Beach for 1 week and then took off radio the week before, kind of now ready to rock and roll when it comes to radio and all my businesses. And as I understand, you were an entrepreneur before becoming a representative, am I correct? You were an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I was. I had a couple different businesses. I spent most of my time writing books, but I had some businesses that I was involved with. And believe me, I know what it's like. If you haven't lay awake at night wondering how you're going to make payroll, I mean, that's a religious experience. It'll change you. So I appreciate small business.
Yeah, absolutely. We got to bring them back, and especially when you first get that idea of becoming the individual, then hiring people, and then having that initiative to keep working more and more hours and still be able to say, well, look what I'm making. Someday I'll make a lot more, but however, it's a process, but it's a passion. To say the least. In your book, yeah. The Miracle of Freedom, 7 Tipping Points That Saved the World. I'm, as a historian, I'm very interested in this. This is really looking at specifically the 7 points you talked about, but kind of define freedom for me first, Representative Stewart, because I think that's an important thing, how we define the word freedom, especially what's going on with our country today.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we have so many people who, in my opinion, seem to be willing to give up their freedom and those things that, you know, so many people have sacrificed and fought for. And I don't know, Neil, I guess I could go into a more technical definition and or something, you know, out of the dictionary. But I think at its heart, freedom is the ability for individuals to make decisions and choices about them or their family or their community without the interference of government. I mean, there's all sorts of elements to that. There's religious freedom, there's economic freedom, yes. There's freedom to associate. But at its heart, it's, you know, that ability to determine this is what's right for me.
Absolutely. And it's what makes our country different than any country in the world, is that freedom. But from defining your seven tipping points, it didn't start out in the United States for sure. So which one was the first one that saved the world involving freedom? Tell us about that.
You know, we go back almost 3,000 years. The first story we talk about is the Assyrians and their quest to destroy the kingdom of Judah and the kingdom of Israel. And, you know, people always ask, well, you chose seven, and why seven? And I think, well, you know, it could have been 10, it could have been 12, and in some cases it could have been maybe 100. But these seven that we focus on truly are examples where the world changed dramatically because of what happened here. And had the Assyrians been able to defeat the southern kingdom, as they had the northern kingdom already with the lost 10 tribes, that would have lost the foundation of these Judeo-Christian values that the Greeks began to build upon. They experimented with the idea of democracy. The Romans expanded that. It really became the foundation for much of the thought of Western civilization. And as we look at all of these events, whether it's the Greeks at you know, defeating the Persians at Thermopylae, or whether we're talking about the Roman Emperor Constantine's conversion to Christianity, or even in more modern time, the last one we discussed, which is kind of a favorite of mine because I was an Air Force pilot, and my dad was an Air Force pilot in World War II, and the Battle of Britain, where for a few weeks the balance of the war, I mean, truly the outcome of the war, hung in the skies over Britain with, you know, with a bunch of 16 and 17-year-old young men.
Yes.
And imagine how the world would be different if World War II hadn't turned out the way it was. But there's this common thread that runs through all of these stories, and that is this constant march of freedom to where we have it so available today, and how truly unique, really what a miracle that is.
Oh, it's a true miracle. And if these occurrences in history would not have happened, what would our society, the world, be today, Representative Stewart? What would it look like?
Well, it's hard to say other than, you know, look what it looked like at the time. And let's go back and I'll use the last one we talked about, Nazi Germany. If the Nazis had been successful, if they had won that war, well, the world today would look like Nazi Germany looked like in 1943. If you go back to, let's talk about the Assyrians once again, the first story we talked about. They built beautiful cities. They created some amazing infrastructure, but they were maybe, if not the most, certainly one of the most brutal armies ever created. I mean, what they would do to those people that they defeated, they would impale them, they would flay them, yes. They would skin them alive. They took thousands of them and beheaded them and stacked their bodies outside the walls of the next city that they were heading to terrorize the citizens of that city. Well, that's what the world would look like in some ways. And, you know, again, it's hard for us to appreciate how rare it was for us to have this. It's time now, but most people haven't had that experience.
I mean, that thinking about that, you're right, because then there would not have been the situation in history with the Jewish people that were bringing the one God and all that, and if they basically became slaves, and where would our society today? Would it be just a basically no monotheistic gods at all? So if you look at those just on historically, not Jesus and all the, you know, just but based on those occurrences in the Bible, then going, as you said, Nazi Germany and looking at other types of things. So it does concern. The reason you wrote this book, I think, is that you're afraid about our freedoms right now in the world, aren't you, with what's going on?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt. And you know, I wrote this book before I ever dreamed of running for Congress. You know, I was very happy as a former Air Force pilot. I had a couple businesses. I was writing books. Life was good. But I just couldn't stand watching anymore. As I watched what happened, I just couldn't sit there. And it was just, 3 years ago. I've only been in Congress for, I'm in my second term. I just felt like I had to get in the fight. And part of the reason is what you just said. I mean, I watched what was happening as the government became more and more powerful. You know, Ronald Reagan used to complain about big government, but we've gone well beyond big government.
Yes.
I mean, government has become so arrogant, they've become, frankly, abusive to their own citizens, to the point where you have, for example, you know, people being targeted by the IRS for their political beliefs.
Right.
You have, you know, crony capitalism that enriches a few at the cost of many of us. And, you know, we could go down a long, long list of things, but at its heart, it comes down to this. Washington, D.C. becomes more powerful. They become less concerned about the welfare of their citizens, and they take away our freedoms in the process.
Absolutely. And that's the situation, if you're being a Democrat or a Republican, because there are Democrats out there that believe in not as much government. They believe in some of the social issues. We have a situation on both sides of the table, Republicans and Democrats, that see that freedom is not an important part of this whole process. And it's such an important part because as the United States, we are citizens that are supposed to be helped in the governing of this country. We are not to be basically told what to do, and that is what's happening on both sides of the aisle at times through, as you said, the crony capitalism and through the different things, and we see it on both sides of the aisle, as I'm going, especially our listeners, are a variety base of different things, and this election coming up is showing that, but ultimately, till we show that the importance of freedom, so that freedom from religion, freedom from all these different types of freedom from government, freedom from all these different areas, what's going to happen is complete control that can look a little bit like the Syrians, can look a little bit like the Nazi Germany, can look like specifically parts of the Middle East right now today. And some people, and that's a concern I'm sure you have.
Well, and, you know, as Ronald Reagan said, freedom is only one generation away, and or the loss of freedom is only one generation away, and we're partly into that generation now. But I got to say this, Neil, and I don't mean to sound Pollyannish. I truly believe this, and that is that the American people will wake up. I think we're seeing an awakening now. I think there are so many people, and I have a chance to travel around the country, frankly, to travel around the world in my responsibilities with the Intelligence Committee and Congress, to go to chaotic parts of the world where people are still looking to the United States to be an example. I come home and I talk to people, and many of these people, they get it. They understand this is a dangerous time. They understand this is, to use the phrase in the book, this is a tipping point. And I think that you're seeing just the beginnings of awakening now, when people are saying, no, we are going to reclaim our country. I'm going to preserve the American dream for my children. I'm going to give my children the same thing that my parents gave to me. And we've become dazed and lackadaisical about that over the last few years. But I truly believe we're going to change that.
And that's the important thing, that the difference is that other countries just allowed it to happen. But what makes the resolve of the United States and what makes the United States so special is that we fought for freedom, we continue to fight for freedom, and that even in the today's society, we see the people see the importance of freedom every day, and that we're not going to fall and say, okay, let's just make it simple. Let's make it a socialist country, or let's make it a place where basically it's controlled by the government, because then we lose our ability to have the freedom of speech. Another important thing, we wouldn't have a program like this today where I could talk to you about this and give both perspectives, because guess what? It would be controlled, right, Representative Stewart? So that's another thing that could disappear, is the freedom of the press and the ability to of speech, which I'm sure you're concerned about as well.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, it's hard to pick which one of those freedoms is more important than another. The fact is that they all are. I think at their heart, and we actually, I think, elaborate on this in the book a little bit, at their heart, you have to come back to the freedom of conscience, another way of saying it, religious freedom, the freedom of people to determine this is what I believe, these are the morals and the principles that matter to me. And in many ways, many of these other freedoms are based upon that core principle. But you're exactly right, and we see these freedoms eroding. And let me elaborate, if I could, just quickly. We point this out in the book as well. you know, the fact that a nation is given freedom or they earn freedom doesn't mean that they won't lose it. And we see examples of that in my time as when I was a pilot in the Air Force in, you know, the 1990s. And we see the fall of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yes.
Dozens of countries were had a pathway towards freedom. Former Soviet countries, Warsaw Pact countries, they tended to embrace it. They tried to embrace it. But in the last 10 or 15 years, we've seen many of those countries lose that opportunity. Some of them lost it. Some of them voluntarily gave it up. After World War II, again, dozens of nations voluntarily turned towards communism, towards fascist government.
Yes.
And it took them 50 years to rectify that. So we've got plenty of examples in our own time of nations voluntarily or for other reasons not being able to hold on to that great gift of freedom.
Absolutely, and we have to, as a society, explain and define it. Through your book, we'll define this so that people say, what would our country look like without freedom? And here's what it would be. And then show specific places. Just imagine living in Iraq right now and with ISIS and all the battles. And as a Christian, how you have to, basically, your life is going to be in the balance every minute. Or in Israel, where you don't know if there's going to be another bomb that happens. The freedom to live your life and also be safe is another thing that our country has at least been able to deal with in so many years that we've not been attacked many times. A few, but not many compared to other countries all over the world. And that goes back to, again, this process. So where is the best place we can purchase your book, Representative Stewart? I think what you're telling me is through the book, it gives you the 7 tipping points and also where your concern is right now in society today, historically in the world today, especially in the United States, how we're losing our freedoms and how we have to regain, bring back our country. And that you're one of the people helping and fighting for us in Congress right now to try to change those things. Where's the best place we can find the info?
Well, you know what? I think you can get it almost anywhere. It was a top 5 New York Times bestseller, so it's pretty available. If you're kind of old-fashioned, you can go down to your bookstore. Most of us are going to order it off the Internet. I think, you know, Barnes & Noble or Amazon or any of them, easy to find. If you Google the Miracle of Freedom, you'll have it in, 0.08 seconds, right?
Well, congratulations on the book, especially being an author before then deciding to write that you wrote this book before that, but happy that it's out. But one question I have to ask, because, again, my background, I'm an educator. I own a consulting company. I do consulting and education. What do we need to do to change our education system in this country? Because I'm very concerned about that. And that's a major part of this whole process of losing our freedoms. What do you feel?
Well, you've got to, you've got to educate your the next generation. One of my sons just did 2 years in Teach for America, where he went to an inner city school and taught for 2 years. What a powerful experience that was. But in my perspective, when people ask me about education, as a federally elected official, the thing I tell them is you need me to stay out of it. You know, going back to Jamestown, in fact, we talk about this in the book, going back to Jamestown in 1609, for the first time really in world history, they said, we're going to educate all of our children. Every village, every
yeah.
town, we will take responsibility for educating our kids. Won't be the church, won't be the government, won't be the federal. It will be, of course, that federal government didn't exist at that time, but every community. And that will serve us for 400 years. It should be the model we still achieve to. Let the community, let the families, let the states decide.
Fantastic. And that's what you're fighting for. And it's interesting. And I'm so anti-Common Core. I can at least bring my education perspective always on this on my program, because I will always take my side. I'm anti-Common Core, anti what's happening and with the federal government being completely in control of education and the direction it's going. And then also for freedom of religion, going into the classrooms and being given propaganda that we and my family and my household, I don't want my kids to learn, especially one of my daughters is in public school while the rest are in Catholic. I have 5 kids, by the way, Representative Stewart, and I see the importance of education, and I want, and I'm here to fight for education with my network, and I wanted to ask that question. I appreciate you answering that for me, and best of luck on your continued success in Congress and to bring that message of freedom to the world. So thanks again for calling.
Hey, thank you so much. It's been good being with you, Neil.
All right, take care. Thanks again. All right, bye-bye. You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment.
and Pinterest Neil Haley, and I'm excited about today's show. Always a great Total Celebrity show, and so I'm excited to welcome the program my co-host Rico Rakowski. Rico, how are you, man? And I know you're excited about today's interview and our guest.
Absolutely. High five to you, Neil, and John, welcome. It's fabulous to have you on the show.
So, again, definitely introduce our guest. So, for our listeners, there, this guy, again, I will consider him always a Pittsburgh Pirate to me, but go ahead with introduce our guest. Yeah. Go ahead, Rico. Introduce our guest.
Yeah, John. We got John Lieber here, Major League Baseball pitcher. He played for the Pirates, Chicago Cubs, Yankees, Phillies. We've got lots to talk about, especially from the point of view, to let you know, John. Neil and I are Pirates fans from way back when. We're from the Berg, so we're going to kind of reconnect with with your debut there in 1994 as well. So welcome, Nick. Great to have you.
No, thank you, guys. Thank you so much.
And
we, the thing I fight.
Go ahead, Rico. Go Rico.
The question I was going to ask is, looking at your career and your background there, John, what I find fascinating is that. You're from Council Bluffs, Iowa. I got a couple of great friends from Council Bluffs, Iowa as well. You ended up at the University of South Alabama, and what's in the water down there? Because you have like 15 to 20 people in Major League Baseball, all from the University of South Alabama, and I have to be honest, I hadn't heard of it. And what's the attraction to the University of South Alabama? You guys have been champions in a lot of different ways, from Sun Belt Conference. What's in the water down there?
Well, for me, it was just the aspect of, here I am, a 20-year-old kid, never been out really the Midwest. Got a chance to be recruited by the University of South Alabama, and I'm right there with you. I never heard of the school, didn't know much about it. Had a chance to go down there and visit, fell in love with the campus, the area, the city. Kind of a secretive little place down here, not too many people, know about Mobile a whole lot. I think that's starting to change a little bit, knowing about the area, but, the people are what make this community and this area. And, they really made me feel welcome. And that's where I really learned, how to play the game, the way I knew it coming into the big leagues, just very aggressive, hard nose. It really wasn't a school to where, LSU, or Florida State type of teams where they just kind of let you go out and play. They teach the game, they take the talent that they see and take it out on the field and do a lot of teaching and how to play the game the right way. Obviously Eddie Stanky was the first coach, that got the program on the map and it was just great. Just something I'll never forget. Two great years down here, and obviously I'm living here full time and enjoying every minute of it.
So that's so interesting, John, when you talk about a place like that. A lot of baseball players don't get the opportunity to go to college. They go straight to the minor leagues. What do you think, how that helped you in development? It sounds like it helped you with the mentorship and learning the game, that if you would have went straight to the minor leagues right out of high school. What do you think that?
Well, I mean, honestly, guys, I wasn't even somebody that was looked at in high school. I went to junior college, a pretty well-known program at Iowa Western, Council Bluffs right now. Walked on to the junior college team. They put me a pitcher. Things seemed to start clicking a little bit, but it was just a. It was just a great experience to be able to grow in that atmosphere here at South Alabama and, and not take a chance on, possibly signing after my junior college years or whatever. But it's a maturity thing. It really was. I think I really grew into myself these 2 years down here and became a better ball player because of it.
That's kind of what's tied to it then. When you were down in that, you guys won the Sun Belt Conference Championships while you were there. And you were selected for the Cubs, and you were selected for the Royals. I think it was for the Cubs, and you did not sign. Is that part of that maturing process that you were talking about, as well as that that special flavor that the University of Alabama has that kept you to stay with the team?
Well, I think, yeah, I had a really long conversation with the pitching coach here, Ronnie Powell, after I was drafted, and he felt like another year of the program and going and playing another year of Division I baseball would help me tremendously, and obviously it did. You know, it moved my position up in the draft to from the ninth round to the second round, and you know, and I think that was a wise decision because, you know, really my junior year was probably I've never had success like that at any level when I was growing up as a ball player, and it just kind of took me by surprise a little bit, and so I was able to kind of, you know, to pull that in, you know, to put a handle on it a little bit. My senior year, enjoyed the ride, and I was a little bit more prepared, I think, going into the draft the next year.
And it seems like that preparation and that process that you had some maturity. Would you say that this, for a college kid, mature enough to wait? Do you equate that from growing up at home, family life, and stuff like that, to not just jump at something? What would you think, John?
No, probably not. I'll be honest with you. I just don't know. You know, I think it was more intimidation than anything. You know, it made me really look at it a little bit closer on to really see if I was really ready to make that move. And, you know, I think I was. I think I was intimidated a little bit. You know, I wanted to learn a little bit more. Playing the game another year in college baseball, and I just wanted to have fun while I was doing it. So, I think that was probably the biggest decision, is looking at that an intimidation thing and making sure that I was ready. And you know, obviously, I'm glad I made the right decision.
Well, it definitely sounds like it. Does. He made the right decision, right, Rico?
Well, yeah. I mean, not only that, but it looks like it got him attracted to the Pirates in 1994.
Exactly. And do you think we'd have John Lieber on that if he was the Pirate? No, I'm just kidding you, John. But go ahead, Rico.
No, it's all good. It's all
good. You had a couple of questions. I know, Neil, that you want to talk about the coach and, you know, and the Pirates.
Oh, yeah. Thinking about you, John, especially, I look at the Pirates in the 90s. I think of the great teams, okay? I look at specifically enough, you know, the years of the disappointment almost to the World Series, and then you become a Pittsburgh Pirate when everything is kind of falling apart. Wholesale, selling off players, people leaving. It had to be a difficult transition, especially in Pittsburgh, because Pittsburgh was so disappointed based on how small market baseball completely was just collapsing right in front of you. Would you agree, going to the Pirates and seeing that firsthand, what was happening?
Well, you know, honestly, I was just thrilled to death to be making my debut with the Pirates. I think everything else was just in the rear view mirror. Or I just wasn't even really paying attention to it. So, you know, I know for that first year or two. But obviously when McClatchy came in, I think he purchased what, the Pirates in 97 or 96. Is that
yeah,
right?
I think so.
That's when I really started to notice things, you know, the economics of baseball teams and what they're going through and how it affects the team and stuff like that. The 94 team, when I came up, it was great. You know, there were some great guys I was able to get a chance to be teammates with. And, that first year is something you never forget. And, and obviously the growing pains that, you know, when they made all the cuts, you know, to the $9 million payroll in 97, was really tough, you know. And, I just kind of looked at, I was basically a little naive, going out there. I'm just trying to win ball games and do the best I can. And, and it's tough, with the situations you're under and the team isn't doing, you know, isn't spending as much as, you wish they could, but,
Exactly. It's,
And that's certainly something we don't see as fans on the other side, you know, and we don't understand what's going on in the locker room and those kind of thoughts that go through your mind. And so it sounds as if that's where perhaps Major League Baseball that transition. We, in fact, Neil and I just talked about that earlier in his background. In when he was a professional wrestler, there's some things that you're naive about in life that you just step into, and then you start to learn as you go.
Well, the other thing that didn't help, obviously, I think the power situation was a strike in '94. You know, that put a hurt on everybody.
Yes.
Obviously, that tied their hands and other clubs as well. And, you know, that was an ugly situation there for a few years. And then with the sale and, but I think the way the game is now, you look back at that, 20 years ago or 15 years ago, it's obviously changed to a point of things are going in a much better direction, in the right direction.
Oh, I love the small markets, John, are finally competing for titles.
They you got to remember now, they always said back then, they said they'll never be able to compete, that's the one thing I never forgot is, you don't know, but obviously they're competing and it's great. It's awesome. Everybody's a win-win situation. So
I think it's bringing baseball back for sure, where you could have a Kansas City Royal team in the World Series. You have a Pirates competing for a World Series. You have teams that you don't have these monster payrolls being in the run. And so it's for sure.
That's it. That's exactly right. So, the game has evolved so much different compared to when I first came in, and it's just a completely different ball game to scouting, to stat analyst, and whatever. The bullpens are deeper. You might hardly ever see a 21 game winner hardly anymore because they use their bullpen quite a bit, or complete games or whatever. So. It's changing. Obviously the social media has made a big impact on it. But it's helping everybody out. And especially, a city like Pittsburgh has been, hungry for that for so many years, and to see them where they're at now after so many, losing seasons. I mean, it's satisfying. I mean, it's gotta be.
Mm-hmm. Just my own sense of humor, I guess. But talking about losing seasons to a degree, here you are, you transition to the Cubs. It's a different kind of season for the Cubs. I mean, the Cubs are always the Cubs. There's just something that's different about that organization versus Pittsburgh. And granted, everybody wants to win. I'm not saying you don't want to, but isn't there a certain quality about the Cubs? It's a different presence, a different vibe, a different.
It used to be, but that's all changed. I've had a chance to go back to a couple conventions, I think, with Theo and with the new ownership. They're dead serious about the championship.
Yes.
I can honestly say that it's a whole different atmosphere. I just noticed it this past year, just being around some of the guys, and I know other people, you just see the Cubs, you just think, last 50, 80 years, 100 years or whatever, but they're on the brink of really being good. I think Theo's done it.
Well, we don't want to hear that, John. That's not good news for Pittsburgh.
They're behind the Pirates.
I'm happy for both teams. I mean, I really am. But I mean, it's just that's great just to have that competitiveness within your league. Two teams that honestly had struggled to be at the top for so many years, and here they are. They're being very competitive here these last 3 or 4 years. That's great to see.
Definitely. And now tell me about how amazing it was, especially when you talk about, I think that you're being very nice and polite when it talks about the Pirates and how you saw the change of the unbelievable, crazy Pirate fans to hardly anyone in the seats. The Wrigley Field, playing in Wrigley Field must be amazing. Do you agree with me? Every day, to play in a ballpark where even regardless of what the Cubs record is, those fans are fanatics, aren't they?
Oh yeah, they're diehards, and I think that I didn't care to pitch at Wrigley Field as a visiting player, but when I had the chance to play over there, I fell in love with it because I love the day games. The day games were great. It seemed like, you actually had an evening to go do something with your family or whatever, and you were out of the ballpark by at least four or five on those day games. So that was nice to be able to experience that. I know I think position players didn't care for it too much, but for a pitcher, I'm loving it every day. So, the atmosphere right there with the ballpark in the middle of the neighborhood was just great. It was awesome.
All right.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, John, that comes to mind, because as you talk about the difference between being pitching as a member of the team in Wrigley Field and pitching as a visiting, from a visiting team, there's something that's a little bit different. Yet, across the board, one of the things I find fascinating about being a pitcher in particular is how do you stay focused on one pitch at a time? It's not the last pitch that was either if they hit it for home run or it was a walk. How do you stay focused on that one pitch at a time to deliver your best fire?
This may sound odd, but I really tried to focus on pitch to contact. I wanted the hitters to put the ball in play, let my defense work for me. I tried to concentrate a little bit more if I had a hitter in a hole, if he's behind 0-2, 1-2, making sure that the pitch wasn't too good of a pitch, if you know what I mean. So, but early on in the count, I just, it was just nice. Hey, man, here it is. Hit it. I'm going to challenge you. Most of the time, I would like to take out the successful, it just made it a little bit easier thought process.
Now, John, what team would you say is the team that you bleed of the Major League Baseball teams you played for? Because we're going to talk a little bit about your Yankee career, but what team do you consider yourself? What do you consider yourself? If you were going to the Hall of Fame someday, or we were getting inducted to something, and they had to say, this is the painting that they're going to have to paint of me wearing which uniform?
It would probably have to be Chicago. The reason I say that is just I felt like that's where my career finally started to take off.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Nothing against any of the other teams. I had a successful year in New York and Philadelphia. But I just felt like that's where I finally evolved as a pitcher and had some of my best years as a baseball player. So as far as, the team to really give me the opportunity, obviously it's the Pirates. I couldn't say enough about them giving me the chance to play in the big leagues. I mean, they're the ones that took a chance on me and traded for me and, gave me every opportunity to be out there every fifth day. So that's something I'll never forget right there as well.
Enrique, remember we were talking about when we were looking at his Wikipedia, how he started as the opening day starter a few times too. And not many people can say that, right, Rico?
No, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. And then, going back to the Cubs too, you're on the All-Star. You're named All-Star.
At
the Cubs, I think. I could see an association there. Although, the Cubs are behind the Pirates right now.
Yes, they are. Quite a bit, too.
Only three games. I think that the Cubs and the Pirates are probably going to play the one-game playoff. That's what's going to end up happening, probably.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm agreeing with that.
Well, he has to. Then he's going to be liked in the two places. If he's traveling to Pittsburgh, he'll say, "Okay, John, all right." In Chicago, he's already beloved in Chicago. Now, Rico and I were also talking about what's really interesting: your days with the Yankees. Because John, it's interesting you talked about the Cubs, but playing for finally a winner like the Yankees that year, was that a memorable year for you? Would you say
it really was? It was just kind of I think I was more focused on just staying healthy I really didn't get a chance to really take it all in, I guess. It was exciting, obviously. I mean, to go out there and, shoot, if you give up four or five runs, you're still going to win the ball game, I guess. So, on most occasions, But it was just more of a thing. I was really just trying to find myself again, to where I needed to be, coming off that surgery. And, you know, and it took a while, but, you know, the timing couldn't have worked out better to, you know, to where I felt like I was my old self and late, you know, in September there, and then going into the playoffs, was probably one of the most exciting times I've ever had in my career. So, it was exciting, definitely a stacked team top to bottom, but, little bit different too. So
definitely. And did you ever win? Would you, the Cubs, when you were with the Cubs, did you win much at all, John, when you were with the Cubs? Did you have any successful winning seasons?
I think just 2001 was the only year that we had a winning season. We were in the run there until late August, and then we just kind of fell out of it. Houston and St. Louis got hot. I think we ended up 5 games behind them at the end of the year. But, you know, it was just I really thought we had a chance to really get to the playoffs that year, but it just didn't work out.
Definitely. And
but going to it, I was going to tie back to all that, John, and especially with tied to New York, too, is how do you what's it like, or how's it done? I mean, I've never been on that your side of the fence there. How were you approached by New York? I mean, are there rumors out there that, hey, somebody's scouting for you, or how is it that you get contacted with regard to somebody like New York, for example, after you came?
Well, I think what happened there when 2002 through the season, obviously I optioned for to have the surgery done. So I think, and Joe Girardi was a teammate of mine, in Chicago, and he played for the Yankees, and then Oscar Acosta, who was the pitching coach in the Yankees organization. I think they both put an award for me to the front office about giving me a chance to sign, and I think they knew, you know, obviously Joe and Oscar knew the type of person I was, the kind of character I carried, and you know, I think that helped in the long run, and they were able to give me a 2-year deal, and it worked. You know, worked out great.
Definitely seemed like it worked out great. And would you say Yankee Stadium and Wrigley Field are your two favorite stadiums? Would you say, with the tradition in both of them?
I would probably say so. Yeah, definitely. I think that's a fair assessment.
And when you were in New York, was that harder to read the newspapers and look at the news compared to, like, Chicago or Pittsburgh because of how New York's media is? Was that hard for you to get used to?
No, man. I don't think I was hardly ever in the paper. It was everybody else, you know, all the bigger names. So
anytime you got in the paper, it was for doing something good. So it didn't matter. They were not expecting much from you, John. So that's it. Yeah. That's a good.
I was flying under the radar.
Flying under the radar. Go ahead, Rico.
No, go ahead.
No, that's okay. That's cool. No, I was just going to say, as Rico, I can't fly under the radar, Rico, as Rico and I talked about my days in pro wrestling. But go ahead, Rico, with the next question.
Well, the thing that I thought was kind of interesting, you know, you and I had talked about how players, it's probably something that we don't think about, somebody who's outside the professional world, how players and coaches take care of each other. And Neil talked about that in his professional wrestling side, about the mentorship and close connections that you make within the sport that help you to move around within the sport a little bit. So I found that fascinating in terms of your description of how, you know, you make some connections there with New York.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who would you say are mentors in baseball for you? Tell me some of that mentored you in baseball, you'd say, in the major leagues, that you would say are players that you hung out with and really learned a lot from?
I'm going to go from organization to organization, I guess. But, you know, Jay Bell, when I first came up, Mike Kingery was another one. Mm-hmm. Jeff King. Let's see, going to the Cubs, it was probably Mark Grace until, you know, he signed with Arizona. Kerry Wood was another one. Jason Schmidt was another one. Kevin Tappany, great guy. I'm trying to think who else. Going to New York, it was Tony Clark, John Flaherty. Those two guys come to mind. Philadelphia, probably Real Cormier, Aaron Foltz. Those guys, it's just certain guys you just never forget.
Yeah, interesting. That's a great point you brought up, Rico, about the brotherhood. There's definitely a brotherhood in any sport, especially you've played with them and you were on the road with them and you traveled with them either in the plane or on train or in the car, and you developed that camaraderie and friendship through that process because of being away from your family.
And then we get to the offices and we don't talk to one another until spring training. So.
That's the same thing that happened for wrestling. I go on these tours or work these towns, and then guess what? Then till the next time we see each other again, same thing happens. Yep. Your brotherhood when you're with each other, but when you go separate places, it disappears. Kind of almost like college roommates in certain ways. Yeah. So, Rico, the way we always finish up our show is that Rico has a survey for you, John. So go ahead with the survey, Rico.
Yeah, John, we have we've got to look at life as in every moment in life, there are just two choices, and you're going to either do the, we'll talk about the positive side, live the dream and goal, or make a choice that takes you closer to that dream and goal in spite of your fear, for example, or something that perhaps doesn't make a stronger contribution to it. And so when you look back at life, the question we ask everybody at the end of the show, and there's no right answer to it, is, what percentage of life do you think is choice? Is it 75-25, 80-20? What do you feel like in terms of how things have unfolded in your life? How much of life do you think is choice?
Repeat that question again. What is it again?
Yeah, how much of life in your day-to-day life do you feel that you are in charge of, that is your choice, that you really made that happen for yourself?
90 seconds.
10, 20
seconds. Okay, that is my choice.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Your choice.
I'd say 80-20. Yeah.
Interesting. John, is there a place we can find information on you and learn more about you? Is it Wikipedia, or do you have a website, or do you have other things that you're promoting that you want to promote on the Tonight Show?
Probably the Wikipedia.
You're just being a good friend of mine on Facebook coming on the show, right? And I appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
And we'll promote it. And anytime, John, you're welcome back. But also, if you're promoting something, please reach out to me so I can make sure I can promote that for you. If there's an event, anything, you have me on Facebook, you shoot me a message and you're back on.
No problem. Thank you guys so much.
All right. Well, take care, John. It was good talking to you.
All right.
Take care. All right. See you later.
Great chat.
Okay.
Thanks,
okay.
John.
Bye-bye.
Same here. Bye-bye.
All right. That was, again, John Lieber.
Thank you for using Blog Talk Radio. It was a great show.
You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, and we'll be live very soon again. Thanks again. Bye-bye.